Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature historian, Harvard professor, and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore. Lepore's books and articles take as their subject the stories of figures and events often forgotten in the margins of history, whether it's Jane Franklin, Benjamin Franklin's younger sister, or the true story behind Wonder Woman. In this talk, she takes on arguably her biggest subject ever, the entirety of American history. The occasion for her visit to Portland was the publication of Lepore's These Truths, A History of the United States. The idea for the book came from a dare from her publisher. What if she took on the whole of U.S. history, but did it her way? The result is an accounting of the country's past that is both familiar and also very new. At its core, it asks whether we have kept the founding promises of the country, these self-evident truths. As she follows truth through the history of the United States, Lepore introduces not only the giants of our history, but, like so much of her work, excavates and brings forward the experiences of those often left out of the national story, including many women and people of color, whose lives and work had great impact on the course of American history. As she says in her talk, we can't unlock the prison of the present without the past, which is the key. Here's Lepore.
Hey, good evening. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew, for that wonderful introduction, and also thanks, Amanda, and everyone at Literary Arts. It's amazing to be here, although I have to say, this evening feels like a bit of a footnote after my visit to Madison High School today. So thanks to the students at Madison High for like one of the best hour-long discussions of American history I've ever had. I'm so grateful to them. It was amazing. I've written this 900-page account of American history, and I want to just let you know the last 200 pages are endnotes and bibliographic material. So it's a really, it's a swift, it's a page-turner. You know, you never know where it's going. It has a surprise ending. So enjoy. So when I thought I'd come out and talk to you all about this weighty volume in a matter of under an hour, there are not a lot of ways to communicate, I think, the whole scope and sweep of American history. But what I want to do tonight is actually show you some pictures and try to communicate that scope and sweep visually, just as a sort of a shorthand for the case that I want to make, which is that we can't really understand where we are today. We can't unlock the prison of the present without having a much longer view of American history at a time when it's very difficult, I know, to get beyond the latest push notification, to get any vantage on anything. Most of us don't remember last week, which was a really rough week. But it's amazing how distant last week seems to us, I think, today. So to begin with, I want to suggest to you that our very present-focused, I think very narrow, blinded present is actually deeply involved in thinking about the past. All of our politics, in fact, involves making historical arguments. We just make these quite reductivist historical arguments. We make arguments about the relationship between the past and the future as expressions of our political commitments. This is true on the left and on the right. It has become ubiquitous. It has, of course, been a long-standing part of American political argument that we rest our claims on historical vantages that we hold, that some new leaders are betrayals of past leaders, as here Obama representing a kind of betrayal of George Washington. Obama's campaign for change, of course, was countered by Tea Partiers who rallied against change itself. And that is roughly how our politics, our hyperpartisan politics, divides, right? We have progressives who are making an argument about the future and conservatives who claim to be making an argument about the past. But both of those arguments, of course, are historical arguments. So what I want to suggest then is we're left in this sort of trap of the present, where everything that we look around and see seems to be to have a past and have implications for a future, but it's very difficult to get your bearings beyond quizzically asking this question. So what I want to do then is to insist that we could get our bearings better if we would dedicate ourselves to thinking about how things began. Because especially for things that are hard, that we object to, it's very difficult to envision how something terrible that's going on in the world can end if you don't really understand how it began, the forces that led to its creation. So the way I want to try to do this, to try to illustrate for you this evening, is to suggest that we could see as a kind of visual shorthand for change over time, we could look at how people represent the world graphically. So all peoples in all times and all places represent themselves graphically as existing in a world. They position themselves as people in a larger cosmos. This is from a beautiful Aztec codex, one of the few that happens to survive. And the figure here at the center of this representation is at the center of the four points of the compass. This is a map of the place of humankind in the geographical world, in the world that we inhabit, and the spirits who guide us through this world, and the beliefs and the elements of the natural world that are critical to our understanding of our place in the world. We all carry around in our minds versions of this conceptual map that locates ourselves. And these kinds of representations tell us a lot about politics, that is, broadly in the sense of what is the political order, what is the arrangement, what are the set of rules under which we live, how do we constitute ourselves as political societies? What does that mean? What does that look like? How would we picture that if we wanted to picture how we represent ourselves as political societies? This is a really, I think, very beautiful version of that kind of a representation. These are four deerskin hides that are stitched together and embroidered with these tiny, exquisite seashells that are embroidered here. This is an Algonquin, it's a cloak, it's a deerskin cloak that was worn, is thought to have been worn by Powhatan, who was Pocahontas' father, who was an Algonquin leader. And here, he is the man at the center, like the man of the figure at the center of the Aztec codex. He is, Powhatan himself is this man, the male figure, human figure at the center. And to either side of him are his spirit guides, the animals who are his spirit guides. But this is a representation of the political order. The circles, there's 30-some odd circles, those are the villages that are subject to Powhatan's rule. They're the sort of tributary villages of his central order. So this is a kind of a map. It's a conceptual map. It's a religious representation of the world and of the ordering of man and animals and subject peoples. And it is a deeply political representation. It's a kind of constitution, right? It's a representation of the constitution of Powhatan's authority. So we could look all over the world in all times and places and we will find versions of this. What I want to concentrate our attention on this evening is how is America represented over time? Because if we could get a glimpse of that, we could see something changing over time that might help us to see where we stand and where how we would represent ourselves or our body politic on a page today, how we might want to picture that political order. So it's important to remember that from the vantage of Europe, before 1492, the world was generally represented this way. This is called a T-O map, because it's a T in an O. And it's clever. And this is the convention of having north at the top of a map is a fairly recent convention. North is over here, so you have to kind of crane your neck. This is a geographical representation in some ways of the three parts of the world. Peoples in Europe and Africa and Asia understood the world as being divided into three parts. And for medieval Christians, that was perfection because it was a trinity. It was a representation of the trinity itself. So Europe, Asia, and Africa, which are here also labeled after the three sons of Noah, the three biblical sons of Noah, which are said to have founded these three parts of the world surrounded by water. This is a religious representation of humans' place in the physical world. People who, the cleric who made this map and who drew this map in the 7th century understood that the world was a sphere. This is just a graphic representation of the world as a perfect circle, because that is the most perfect form of divine order, right? So that's why the O is there. The T is within the O. It's not that Europeans thought that the world was flat. It's that this is how they represented the beauty of God's design. So it's a religious map. This happens to have been the first map of the world ever printed. It was printed in 1472. It was a very old map, but it was in a popular and still widely read manuscript book. And it had the misfortune, of course, of becoming obsolete 20 years after it's drawn. But what happens from the European vantage after 1492 is that map makers have to struggle to figure out what to do with a fourth part of the world. If the world has been three parts since as long as people have been making maps, what do you do with the fourth part of the world? And the first map maker to really reckon with this in a way that mattered and lasted and ended up proving quite influential was a German map maker named Martin Waldseemüller. He made this giant map. These are 12 panels, and it actually is like wallpaper. It's as big as probably it looks on this screen. These are 12 panels that were pasted together on the wall. Waldseemüller was trying to, the way that you would unpeel an orange and then flatten it, trying to represent graphically in a two-dimensional plane, what a globe looks like. And he is trying to use the most recent, most up-to-date, most cutting-edge cartographic knowledge about the world, and also to incorporate this fourth part. So there's something sort of wonderful about how he got this late-breaking news from the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope. The Africa's like, wait, oh, I have to tuck that in. Now, this is breaking news here, rounding the bottom of Africa. And he doesn't know anything, really. Nobody in Europe knows very much at all about this fourth part of the world. So he puts this big green blob over here with, I don't know, a little bit of coastline. You know, maybe there's a little bit of knowledge about Brazil at this point. He has no idea what this green blob looks like, but this is the latest, most up-to-date, most scientific map in 1507, and no one really knows what to call this big green blob. You could label it the fourth part of the world. Columbus thought he had reached the Indies, but Amerigo Vespucci, the Florentine sailor who had traveled in 1503 across the ocean, had written a book called The New World that was published in many, translated and published in many languages, including German. And in fact, Waldseemüller had read a copy of Vespucci's book. It's a very compelling account. And so he put Vespucci on the map. That's Vespucci up there on the right in the red, little red gown. And so on his map, he was like, well, I don't know what to call this fourth part of the world, but he labeled it America. This is why we are living in what is called America. It is because Waldseemüller put this down on the map and people really love this map. History is full of accidents and weird happenstances and mostly chaos and contingency. This is one of my favorites. Like, you just want to be on Waldseemüller's good side and you can have, you know, a fourth of the world named after you. So the idea that this fourth part of the world is America comes to be accepted in Europe, and it is propagated through other visual images. One of the most influential of which is this Dutch engraving, which is also quite popular, which is called Vespucci Awakens a Sleeping America. Here we have America Vespucci again on the left. And now America, allegorically, as has already become commonplace and remains commonplace, is a naked native woman. I always say about America Vespucci that he was the Harvey Weinstein of the Age of Discovery. because this is an image, I know there are high school students here, so I'm going to try to, this is an image of rape, right? This is an image about Vespucci arriving, bringing to this naked, helpless, prone, passive, ignorant, uncultured woman his great knowledge and his science and his technology and his religion and his language and everything that he brings. If you look at the, you can divide the, you might want to put, like, draw a diagonal down here. This is everything that Europe brings, right? All the rich knowledge of Europe. And everything that America has here, which is sort of Garden of Eden-like, is on this side. The hammock is an American, is an indigenous technology. The paddle here, a canoe, is a native boat. So it's both a Garden of Eden and also a hell. Because in the background, if you look above her hand, there's a scene of cannibalism. They're burning roasting a leg, a human leg, over a pit. This is important because Europeans had no real legal claim to take possession in their code of laws, to take possession of these lands, unless they could prove and demonstrate to the Pope or to the king or whoever was asking, and they were often asked, that these people were savage and that they had violated the laws of nature and therefore had no sovereignty over their land. So this is a really important element of this representation of America. It is a land both of plenty and beauty, where I'm trying to think of the PG version of this, where Vespucci will plant his seed, and it will be fertile. That there's this connotation, this really very strong sexual connotation of this representation of Europe's relationship to America, that it remains powerful. We go leap ahead in time to 1588. Here's Queen Elizabeth, the Queen of England. And she, at a time when Spain and France and Holland, even Sweden, have established colonies in this new world, England has failed to do anything except attempt to settle Roanoke and abandon it. But Queen Elizabeth has great aspirations for England's claim to lands in this fourth part of the world, in America. And so here she is very demurely resting her hand on North America. this is a very different claim of possession than Vespucci awakening a sleeping America. This is Elizabeth claiming America as her property. It's a really interesting representation, and I'm gonna just ask you to kind of try to freeze it in your brain, because we're gonna come back to a quite similar 20th century image. But it's a really important way that England stakes its claim, that ways that Europe understood its relationship to the Americas. They're expressed in papers and in treaties, but they're very often expressed in these quite graphic ways. This is a very familiar representation of the British colonies on the mainland. This is a woodcut that was in Benjamin Franklin's newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette. He had it made in 1754 in order to call upon the colonies to form a defensive union against the French and the Indians, join or die. It's a really interesting representation of America as a place here. It comes from the age of the birth of jigsaw puzzles. Jigsaw puzzles were invented by map makers to sell maps. And the reason that they were good to sell maps with was you were trying to teach kids which parts of the world different European countries claimed to own. So you'd make a big map of the world, and then you'd color the different countries different colors, and then you could remove them and put them together so that kids could learn that different monarchs owned different parts of the world. The whole idea that you could own and be a sovereign, could make territorial claims, especially over the Americas, was a part of where maps did work and why jigsaw puzzles were invented in the first place. This is a jigsaw puzzle. They were called dissected maps. This is a dissected snake map. It is also, of course, a map. North now is over here. You think of it just as a political cartoon, but it's a map. Here's New England, and we're just going down the coast all the way down to South Carolina. A really interesting way to think about the relationship between the political relationships of these different constituent elements. America as a naked native woman is a very popular convention, again, for decades and decades and decades, here again being raped. This is America representing now not the land itself somehow, but representing the British colonists being raped by the English. This is a stamp collector who's about to collect taxes, which is portrayed by this political cartoon as an act of rape. This is after the dumping of the tea in Boston, when Parliament passes what's known as the Coercive Acts, which close the port of Boston and impose all these new penalties on Boston. But again, just to suggest that America as a naked Native woman remains a kind of through line in this era. Of course, the Constitution of the United States itself is a pictorial representation of the relationship between the people and the place, right? We are constituted as a people here in this document. Remember that a map, which is called a chart, is a very close relationship with a constitution, which is also known as a charter. They do the same work. They document the relationship between a political order and a geographical space, and that's what the Constitution does. It's the case that from the very beginning of the forming of the United States, the hypocrisy of the advocacy of liberty and struggle for liberty in a land of slavery is a constant source of political commentary and criticism. Here, after the forming of the Republic, that naked Native woman tends to get clothed and she becomes Liberty. She's Lady Liberty. She's an allegory for liberty, also an allegory for America. And often, as in here in this 1792 painting, exists and is used to represent a critique of the failure of liberty to address slavery, to fully reckon with slavery, something that was especially offered by Europeans commenting on America. I can't emphasize enough just how often you see this kind of thing in the archives. This is Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, a woman that he owned and with whom he had a decades-long sexual relationship. They had several children together, all of whom Jefferson surreptitiously freed, but never acknowledged in any public way. This was known at the time, widely suspected at the time, the subject of many political rumors at the time, and here the subject of a political caricature in 1804. This isn't exactly a representation of America, but I want to just make sure to emphasize, I think you can see the relationship between the depiction of this sort of almost allegorical Sally Hemings representing all enslaved peoples and the woman here in this 1792 painting, the depiction of America in a way then here as an African-American woman enslaved by the people who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. This is a mainstay of American political rhetoric from the very beginning, something that has sadly been left out of how we often think in our public culture about the American past. In the 19th century, there are some just, I think, quite exquisite attempts to represent the complexity of the American Republic. This is an allegorical representation of America in the form of a hotel. It's a little bit hard to read here. Maybe I'll point this out to you. It says American Hotel up here, and there's an eagle with a flag on his breast, right? So we're not at the Hotel California. This is the Hotel American. And these people represent the body politic, right? This is an allegory for the United States. And so on the porch of the hotel are a bunch of white men, and they're reading the newspaper, which is how you signify that you're a citizen. You're participating politically by staying informed. Citizens have to stay informed. They're reading the latest news from the war with Mexico. And it's an incredible assemblage of white men on this porch. By the 1840s, all white men can vote. This is known as universal suffrage, kind of perversely. But nowhere else in the world can people who don't have any money vote. From people who don't pay taxes can vote. People who don't own land can vote. People who cannot read can vote. People who only just got to this country can vote. It is an extraordinary blossoming of democracy in the United States in the 1820s and 1830s. So that by 1848, these guys, it's not legible to you looking at it, but I'll just testify as the historian in the room, these guys represent like all ranks and ethnicities and all classes. There's like farmers, there's businessmen, there's bankers, there's hunters, there's an Irish guy. Like they're really, this is diversity in 1848. And they're all on the porch and they're all reading. But then there's something really cool going on here. There's a bunch of different things, and if we were a small group, I'd ask if you could see them, but I'm gonna have to point them out to you. One is that the porch is rotting. Like, it's not actually a good hotel. Two is that over here, can you see this poor figure craning out of the window? This is a white woman who's not allowed on the porch but is listening to the news. This 1848 is the year of the Declaration of the Independence of Women. It's the year that women at a women's rights convention first demand the right to vote. She wants to be in the America. She wants to be on the porch, right? And then down here, sitting on the front porch, standing by the porch, is an African-American man and a child, a boy or a girl. You can't tell from the dress, but the way they're dressed is sort of to signify that they are slaves, right? And they, too, are very attentively listening to the political news. And what's so chilling about this, they are the ones who are in red, white, and blue. So there's just a lot going on by 1848 with the complexity of trying to represent the body of the people and their relationship to one another in this new political experiment. There's a lot by the 19th century, by the 1850s, that's familiar to us. This electoral map should be pretty familiar to you. It's creepy, right? It's concerning. It's concerning. So these are often sold as jigsaw puzzles, too. It's a big thing to buy jigsaw puzzle maps of the continental United States. So by now, there's a continental vision for the country, you know, including the Oregon territory. But map makers choose to represent the country by depicting the different states in different colors to indicate their political affiliation. So we have the free states, including California, which enters as a free state in 1850, the slave states, and then the unorganized territories here. You're still unorganized? But this becomes a source of meaning, right? It both reflects the truth of the situation, like that's how the laws work in these different places, but it also creates divisions. It asks people to carry around in their head a picture of the country that looks this way. We carry around this picture today, and it has real implications, I think, but it comes from the years before the Civil War. Here's Sojourner Truth in 1864, in the middle of the Civil War. A former slave, famed orator, an abolitionist, very formidable woman, incredible speaker. And she here is offering her version of the relationship between Americans and America. And you have to look at it for a minute. Can you see what's going on? So if you follow the skein of yarn with which she's knitting, here we have Maine, Florida, Texas. This is a claim of ownership, not unlike Queen Elizabeth's. I made this country with my two hands. This is my country. I am a citizen of this country, and I made this country. I built this country. It's a very, very sneaky, sly, brilliant, coy, forceful, stunning representation of the relationship between a people and a nation. There's a lot from the 19th century that is familiar to us in weird ways, too. The idea that the United States has or should have a wall at its borders comes from 1882. Before the 1880s, the borders are open. There is no federal law that restricts immigration until the 1880s. It would be preposterous to propose such a thing, and when one is proposed, it is very hotly contested, but it is the Chinese exclusion law, and here it is being derided and critiqued by a political cartoonist who's suggesting that as China is dismantling the Great Wall of China, a group of American immigrants to the United States are building a wall at the western border of the United States on the Pacific coast. This notion of a wall kind of, it pops up and then it recedes, it pops up and then it recedes. And it's at the very same time, of course, that the Statue of Liberty is erected in New York as a beacon welcoming immigrants from Europe, the huddled masses, as offering an asylum to those who would flee Europe. There are other really whole other strains I won't have time to talk about, but there's a really interesting convention of the quilting of flags, which are one of the ways that women, in addition to that knitting, incredible knitting thing of Sojourner Truth, that women express their political bonds and their political aspirations. This is a suffrage flag. The names that have been embroidered here are people who have donated to a suffrage campaign. Susan B. Anthony is in one of the lines here. A lot of 19th century imagery is not used today. We don't talk about the People's Party as a balloon of patches, but we actually sometimes talk about populism as raggedy, as kind of uncouth, as full of hot air. But the way political cartoonists talked about populism in the 19th century was often this way, recall that populism in the 19th century was left populism. Populism only became a right thing in the 20th century. But one of the things you see here and get a glimpse of is the great contempt with which Eastern magazine editors represented populists who tended to be Westerners. Plutocrats, sort of the Mr. Monopoly version of the notion of America as a place with a particular relationship between people and place, have a lot of powerful representations from the first Gilded Age here. What I love about this, don't check out the, he's stealing the piggy bank from this little toddler. By the 19-teens, suffrage has entered a new era of militancy, and that representation of America allegorically as a woman, now in bondage, tied up or chained up, is the principal iconography of the suffrage movement. Suffrage cartoonists like Annie Rogers, here Annie Lou Rogers, drew America as a woman who is tied up, chained by the tyranny of men. There's a new anxiety, though, by the 19-teens about the relationship between people and the political order, which is the anxiety around mass democracy. With the size of the population, with new immigrants, especially with rising immigrant populations, but also the particular challenges of mass democracy in an age of gross income inequality that we associate with the Gilded Age, here Henry Ford's motor plant. Some sense in which we are somehow now anonymized. We are just little pieces in a much bigger world. We have very little. This is essentially a representation of statism. There's a lot of concern about statism in this era as well. That set of concerns, especially about mass democracy, leads to the big wave of immigration restriction in the 1920s and the 1924 National Origins Act, which is essentially a eugenics act that asks the Americans not to build a wall, but to install a big funnel. I sometimes think this is about to come back as a icon. It represents a lot of views that people have, that you could funnel out just the people that you wanted, just the people that met your eugenic requirements here, is what's going on here. The representation of America as a superpower is a really interesting turn. These Captain America from 1940, Wonder Woman from 1941, are really very different from, but also not unrelated to, that woman in Vespucci Awakens a Sleeping America. They do represent the United States and the ideals of the United States here, not of all the Americas, but of the United States in particular as a nation state, in the figure of a single individual, an allegorical individual, but here imbued in the sort of comic book world with superpowers. And this is about the expression of American power in the world. Remember, the United States, of course, survived the First World War virtually unscathed. The war devastated Europe, ruined European economies, destroyed European cities, dwindled European populations. The United States lost nothing, except, and all it did really was gain, because all the European countries were in debt to the United States. The United States benefited a great deal from the First World War, survived it unscathed, got through the Depression in a way that that European countries did not, had resources that European countries did not because of having been spared that war, and emerges even before the beginning of the Second World War as a superpower with this vision of itself. What Wonder Woman is trying to do is make the world safe for democracy and for women's rights. She comes to the United States to fight for women's rights and then represents America. At the same time, of course, America has failed to fight itself for equal rights. So the great promise of emancipation and of reconstruction is failed through a series of compromises that lead to segregation and Jim Crow and the terror of lynching over many decades, that in the four decades of the first part of the 20th century lead to the greatest migration in American history, in which millions of African Americans leave the South, just pick up and leave, and cross the continent to go somewhere where they will not be subject to racial violence and racial terrorism, subject to the daily humiliation of segregation and Jim Crow. The Great Migration, of course, here depicted by the great painter Jacob Lawrence, in what, in my mind, has kind of conjures the shape of the continent, the movement of people across a continent, a quite beautiful representation of the challenge to find democracy within a country that is not realizing the promise of democracy. I asked you to hold that Queen Elizabeth in her globe in your mind because we're coming back to, this is FDR in 1942, and I just, like, you could teach a whole seminar on this plus Elizabeth. That's just so you, he kind of says a lot, both of these. So this was a gift given to FDR, but this is at a moment when FDR is imagining the United Nations and planning for a post-war order, even before the war is over, in which the United States will assume a role as the protector of a liberal world order. Democratic societies, rights-based institutions, open markets, open borders. This is what the United States will promise the world and will take on the Atlas-like burden of supporting European countries and supporting self-determination of peoples around the world. This is the vision that FDR brings to the post-world order, and it is the vision, indeed, of the United Nations at its, in any case, at its founding. But it is also a quite audacious representation of American power in the world, which is, of course, backed up by what FDR calls the arsenal of democracy, the tremendous military production and output of the United States. What also comes out of that production and output of the Second World War is the technology of the modern general-purpose computer. Mainframe computers are built during the Second World War to break codes and to calculate missile trajectories, things that require very fast computations. What is available at the end of the war are computers that can use that high-speed computation to conduct all kinds of other analysis. And we have, I think, not fully reckoned with the long history of how computers influence our political arrangements. But this is a representation of the American people in its own way. We are here, we are bits of data in a machine that is tracking our every feature as a people, our sex, our gender, our age, our ethnicity, where we live, how much we pay in taxes. That information is kept and tabulated, beginning with the census on computers in 1950. The UNIVAC, the first general purpose computer for commercial use was built, the first one was built in 1951 for the US Census Bureau in order to do that work of sorting and segmenting and counting the population. And that demographic work is the basis for so much that comes down to us in our day by way of the representation of a population, the relationship between a people and a place as mediated by a machine. The UNIVAC was first used, there was only one. It was first used in 1952 to predict a presidential election. On election night in 1952, here's a very handsome Walter Cronkite. And here's us. We are the American people. We're on this like sheet of paper. We are represented by the output of a computer. It's a really wonderful story, the story of the 1952 election prediction night that I'm happy to tell in the Q&A if we have time. But this idea that we should understand our relationship to the world as mediated by the machinery of a general purpose computer is very, of course, powerfully represented here on the cover of Life magazine right after Sputnik, in which these are MIT engineers who are reading computer printouts, and they now have the Atlas-like burden of figuring out who we are and what our place is in the world by doing some faster, better coding. That all of that kind of mechanization and automation, the sort of sorting and segmenting and counting, is subject to a lot of critique, of course, at the time. It also creates a lot of anxiety. This Jasper Johns map is this kind of dripping, messy, bleeding, crazy, I am not a computer printout representation of the land and of the people that belong to it. It's one of course, a series of quite stunning and disturbing works that represent the American people in an era of great political turmoil, much of which takes the form of protest art. This is a beautiful silkscreen that was made in California for use in an anti-war rally. The flag takes on a new valence, especially during the 1960s and 1970s when the American bicentennial is being celebrated. And for a long time in the 1960s, it's just being planned and then it's being celebrated. And it's the subject of great contestation. How should the United States celebrate its bicentennial? So the flag, which of course has a long history as a political symbol, gets a little more raw as a source of contestation. And also, there's a sort of bumper sticker battle around the American flag. And this is the great era of the rise of political polarization that leads us down to our own day. There are also some, I think, quite stunning bicentennial flags. This is a quilt made, a piece of folk art, right? African-American quilter from Alabama for the bicentennial. And it predates the whole sort of rainbow coalition, kind of gay pride iconography, but it has that, it makes that gesture. It's like such a beautiful piece of folk art, a way to kind of think about color and space and a country. The way that we think about the United States or any other nation is, of course, greatly challenged by the environmental movement, and especially after the environmental movement takes as its icon these photographs taken from space that ask us to ignore the fiction of these political boundaries that have been drawn on maps since the age of discovery and turned into dissected jigsaw puzzles that ask people to think about as if these things are actually drawn in the world when they're, of course, purely imaginary. We're asked now to remember we inhabit this whole place. This is our home, not any particular state or nation. When I get to this point in my American History Survey class, I always just show this slide, and then I stand up and I say, explain. So this is a chart that plots two different pieces of information. It begins here right after the Second World War, 1946, and it goes to 2012. And in red, we're looking at House polarization. That is to say, the political polarization in Congress. How that's measured, I could explain for you, but it's quite a reliable measure. And you'll see that there's very little polarization in Congress in the decades, in the years from about 46 to about, we say, 72, maybe 75. And then ever since, polarization has been on the rise. We're like way over, we're up here now. and then in blue, we're measuring income inequality with a measure that's known as the Gini Index, also a very reliable measure. And you'll see that from the end of the war till about 68 or 72, income inequality was relatively low and also relatively stable. I'll give you a hint. This is the GI Bill right here. This is the incredible effect of the GI Bill in the decades following the Second World War. And then after about 68, 72, you see income inequality on the rise. And we're in spite of economic growth, we're still on the rise here. So the reason I say explain is because, of course, the change comes right around 68. And so I asked, what is the relationship between the blue curve and the red curve? It's a really tough question, but this is the world that we have made. And this is where a lot of our problems lie. So the other reason I show this chart to you in the course of this slide lecture is this is a way we think about the world. Social science, right, all that work, that computational work, the US Census data fed into a UNIVAC beginning in 1951, we have incredibly sophisticated social science measures with which to do things like track polarization or income inequality, mobility. There's a lot that we could track and that we can know, and we tend to think of our world in those ways. And sometimes we maybe, I think, resign ourselves as if these are inevitable ways that the world exists, rather than we created this. Everything that is on this map is something that people made decisions about and did. The things that people could make different decisions about and undo. So it's important to, I think about what this kind of a representation does in the world that's different than a map, say, or different than a constitution. Representation of the United States by the end of the 20th century that is most powerful is actually the vision of the United States promoted by Wired magazine, which is founded in 1993 and promises that wiring the country and wiring the world will mean an end to all political division and an end to all income inequality. That's also a laugh line. Wired magazine says the internet will save us all from all of these problems. You can see what a good job it did. Because so long as we're wired, so long as we can communicate with one another instantly and immediately and without hesitation and at the speed of thought and all at once, we will, of course, live harmoniously, happily ever after. It's good. It's Well, it's actually very bad for your soul to go read old issues of Wired magazine. I don't recommend. It's edifying, but it's quite depressing. Some of the best representations of the world since then are works of public art. So I'm going to show you a few more, and then we'll go to questions. This is a work by a Korean-American artist named June Paik. I don't know if you've ever seen it in Washington at the Smithsonian Museum of American Art. It's about as big as that Waldseemüller map. It's maybe the same size. It's like as big as the screen up here. It's a giant, and there's also Alaska and Hawaii. They're not in this photograph. It's a giant neon political boundary map of the United States in which each state is filled with television monitors that are broadcasting broadcasts somehow about that state at top volume. No, it's very painful because you go near it, and if you can sort of discern, if you like almost could put like a cone against your ear, and like from Oklahoma you could hear Oklahoma where the wind goes, like, and then you're like, okay, that's Oklahoma, but you can hear only the merest glimpse of any little bit of noise. There's not like a coherent thought that you can get because it's a cacophony. And you can walk close to it, and you can pull back, and you can turn your head. You can't really actually get a full sentence really out of anything. And it's just a very powerful representation. I mean, this is my simplistic, never took an art history course. You know, we are all broadcasting, but nobody is listening. And in fact, it's impossible to listen carefully. Is what this work says to me. It's called the Electronic Superhighway. It's a piece of art about the internet. So to kind of come back to where we began, we have many ways of representing ourselves as Americans or as citizens or in relationship to the nation or to the states that we inhabit or to the cities that we inhabit or the political parties to which we affiliate ourselves. These have origins and long traditions and earlier representations. Some of those representations are quite troubling. People always say to me, you know, everything seems so unprecedented in this particular moment in American history. And I guess my point is, like, a lot of things are precedented. The wall is a form of political protest itself has a precedent. And I think that makes it more powerful, and it illuminates what's going on in our world when we think about the long history of these things. When we think about that electoral map that is kind of like stuck in our retinas as a way that we picture the country that we live in and the state that we live in. I was talking to someone, I was speaking in New Hampshire last week in Portsmouth, and a woman I was speaking to was telling me that she'd just been on a week-long canoe trip. It was really arduous. It was like you had to get up really early. There were a lot of portages, and it was like just kind of bad weather. And she spent a week. It was just some like group tour thing that she and her wife had signed up for. And she said over the course of the week, just hanging out with the other people who are from all over the country, they realized that they all came from the same latitude, like across to Montana. And then they were like, yeah, because we are the hardy people. Like, you guys are not that far from this latitude, but like, we are the people that could actually endure this canoe trip. And that she was very moved by that because she had never pictured the country as having ties that were the ties of latitude. And it was sort of a moment where the scales fell from my eyes and I saw the country in a different way. Like, what if you didn't have the state divisions and the red states and the blue states, but you actually thought about, you know, plant zone hardiness, plant hardiness zones, which is a way that I often think. I'm a zone sixer, so I think about that. That maybe there are ways that we should try to think differently about how we picture ourselves in relationship to space. So I just want to close with this beautiful work by Glenn Ligon, African-American artist of great renown. He did a series of works that are called Double America, also in neon. There are different versions of them, but they all have this quality of a United States where half the country looks at things this way and half the country looks at things that way. And this way and that way cannot be seen by each other. There's a lot that's communicated here about our current political condition. I mean, think, for instance, of how things line up with, you know, believing Brett Kavanaugh or believing Christy Blasey Ford or whatever, you know, kind of you name it, works in this double America quality. And one of the things that I thought was thought very beautiful about what Ligon has said about this series of works is that he really was thinking about the opening lines of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, which I think is worth our pondering in this moment as well, that it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And it is both of those things. And I want to thank you very much.
That was Jill Lepore speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in October 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Ligori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.